Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Long Shots, our weekly podcast. Yes, this is the season 2 finale, for the lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And we have kind of developed an American sitcom style structure with 16 episodes per season without any rhyme or reason, I think. There's not much rationale behind the number 16. I think it's just the moment when we think that, yeah, perhaps we need a bit of a break.
Yeah, and so do our listeners, I guess, right? And also, the fact that Game of Thrones has begun,
yes.
The other most highly anticipated
yes,
content, piece
yes,
of content,
sir.
Why,
yes,
you know, I don't want to divert too much traffic away from those guys. So,
yeah,
might as well.
Spot on. I mean, I'm sure HBO would totally agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they must be obviously plugged in right now.
Yeah.
So, nevertheless, on that self-deprecating humor note, we can kick off our season finale. I'm very excited, man. And friendly reminder, as usual, to all our listeners, we are streaming on various different eclectic mix of apps, be it Deezer, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple, and so on. So do check it out. Do check our channel, Long Shot, search for it, and hit subscribe so that you get that nice little notification every time an episode goes live. And next season is going to be pretty exciting as well, Sharad, because we are planning something new. No spoilers at the moment, but hopefully something fresher,
yeah,
should come in season 3. I'm assuming sometime mid May.
Yeah,
as per our highly planned, schedule.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it, and we'd really appreciate if we can get some inbound comments and feedbacks, if a thumbs up or a thumbs down, so that season 4 can be structured accordingly. But I'm looking forward to, and I like the fact that you've created a little bit of a suspense now, like a
yes.
cliffhanger.
Yes, a cliffhanger. Yeah, I mean, HBO obviously must be like wondering, oh my God, we'll be out of a season now.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? Anyways, so okay, I think we kind of went a bit overboard there. So, today, again, a news-heavy week. Lots of things going on the geopolitical front. Of course, the week started with a kind of tragedy in Sri Lanka. I mean, unfortunately, that's not an area we cover in a lot of detail. But obviously, our hearts are with the affected families. And but we are going to now quickly, you know, pivot to something a bit more home and something a bit more fitting within our overall interest or right. mandate or whatever you
yeah.
want to say. I would say Paytm Mall.
Definitely up our mandate. No, again, we've touched on Indian startup ecosystem at different points of different episodes in very different ways.
Right.
This is obviously sort of an extension to some of our discussions on what we've talked about and how Indian startups have scaled and grown, shown, you know, very staggering growth in a short period of time when it comes to valuation. And they've also had some strategic tilts and bends, and they've dropped the ball sometimes and not. But there have been one underlying theme amongst all these unicorns, at least most of them, has been differentiating on the basis of discounting, right?
Yeah.
And Paytm Mall is no different.
I mean, it's, I think, a cashback-driven story
yeah.
for most of these guys. And I think the reason why we are looking at Paytm Mall is because I think it was ET Tech which came out with an interesting story start of this week. I mean, we looked at Paytm Mall, I think, a few podcast episodes
yeah.
ago when we were talking about their pivot to from you know, online to offline.
Yeah, yeah. And the role Reliance was also playing in sort of the same O2O space.
Correct. And I think in this news story, what's coming out is that Alibaba, which is a 42% stakeholder in Paytm Mall, in their last board meeting, whenever it happened, pretty much decided to reevaluate a few things, because they just, I think, realized that Paytm Mall burned almost $200 million during the Diwali sale season in October, November last year
yeah.
in discounts and cashbacks.
How much of that did you take claim for?
Sure. I'm actually always very fascinated by the, you know, kind of entire idea of cashbacks. I mean, in the UK, it is it's a big
thing.
Even if you go to like a offline supermarket, they offer you cashback.
And even a credit card, right? Like cashback cards are pretty prevalent.
So, I mean, I used to find that very interesting then. Never understood. I mean, I understood like that as a customer, probably it's a good thing, but never understood why companies are doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously one knows why, but never understood the economic logic behind it.
Yeah.
So yeah, Paytm Mall pretty much going through that same journey. I mean, it's a reiteration of so many of the conversations we have had here, right? That, you know, we look at these, we have been looking at these tech startups, these companies, you know, these unicorns or would-be unicorns, who primarily are using discounting as a business model strategy, right?
Yeah.
And that's the only barrier to entry for anyone else to, you know, kind of take guys away from their platform, just give more discounts, right?
Yeah. So, and for me, like, I mean, I don't know, but I do not see price or discount as a long-term strategic differentiator at all. Like,
yeah.
It will subside someday. It will have to, like, the wheels will come off eventually. And I've seen a lot of companies, like, I mean, you know, when I've looked at closely, who have relied on pricing as a key differentiator, have often stumbled in near to medium term, right?
Right.
It's good to raise capital and gain growth, I guess. But once that wears off, then shit hits the fan, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you need to kind of create some sort of protective moat to ensure that what you are doing is something very unique in terms of a proposition.
Yeah.
And I always feel that, you know, when I'm like ordering food from Zomato or Swiggy, I really don't have any customer loyalty there.
No,
I mean, I'm just looking
not.
At a better offer.
Correct.
Or a better, I would say, collection or portfolio of, you know, options. Same as with, you know, when I'm taking a cab, don't really differentiate much. And I guess e-commerce has a similar pull, but e-commerce is also different in a way because I think it is at the end of the day, It's a capital intensive, logistic and infrastructure driven business.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously Paytm has traditionally been a payments company.
Yeah.
So even though on paper it might sound that there are lots of synergies between e-commerce and payments, but effectively they're two very different types of businesses.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, I think that kind of is something that is also, you know, coming full circle for Paytm Mall.
Yeah. I mean, the only overlap is actually just payments. Logistics, warehousing, everything else is a completely different beast.
Yeah.
And yes, you can argue that the customer base is same or there's data on the customer, so you can, you know, sort of envisage or predict buying patterns. But outside of that, yeah, they're very different businesses. Not too much of cross synergies that you can think of initially, right? And like you said, there is no sort of moat is the word you used, and there is nothing that keeps me loyal to them. At the end of the day, it's just service and price that matters, right? And service is becoming increasingly homogeneous. There isn't, like, I can't see a difference when a Zomato guy delivers or a Swiggy guy delivers, let's call it that way. Or I don't see a difference when an Amazon guy delivers my food, whatever I'm ordering, or a Paytm guy. So it's entirely just price then.
Right.
And that is not a moat at all.
Right. I mean, there's obviously a proposition here.
Yeah.
I mean, it is more convenient to hail a cab through an app rather than, you know, wait on the street.
Yeah.
Similarly, it is a better proposition to order food or order stuff online.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's at the end of the day a commoditized product.
It is.
Right.
Yeah.
So either the proposition in terms of, you know, the customer experience, the service. I mean, that's why I think if you look at like Jeff Bezos, he always, like, I think for the last 20 years he's been just going off, you know, customer service. Because I think, I mean, that's a fair realization that in a business like that, at the end of the day, if every part of the value chain performs well, then there is a stickiness with the customer, right? Otherwise, the product itself is fairly commoditized. It's fairly standardized, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's no wonder that now Paytm Mall is pivoting away from just being a consumer-oriented e-commerce platform and going more towards O2O or online to offline.
Yeah.
Because when you look at local vendors, right, local vendors who don't have access to, you know, who probably just have a smartphone, they don't really have, you know, access to mainstream e-commerce sites, or maybe mainstream e-commerce sites are way too sophisticated for them to understand. They would benefit a lot with a product like Paytm Mall, you know, who provide an online to offline linkage through a easy to use mobile app with which payments are already integrated. Most of these local small vendors already have Paytm accounts.
And I think when we were discussing it last time, when we were talking about Reliance also tapping into this space of onboarding all these local mom and pop stores, Like, I have a guy close to my place where I can order on WhatsApp. And now he's starting, he's asking me that I can pay on WhatsApp as well.
Correct.
It's like completely digitized.
Yeah.
I just have to put in an order, punch in an order what I want on WhatsApp. And he responds also on WhatsApp saying, I don't have XYZ, can I send XYZ instead? Or whatever it is, right? And I can pay via WhatsApp, UPI. So it is happening. And it's just a matter of sort of structuring them together on a combined platform.
So you're saying like with WhatsApp, he doesn't have to go through
nothing.
A Flipkart, right?
Nothing.
I mean, he doesn't have to onboard himself as a vendor on any...
No.
So I mean,
he's got two runners.
So he has become an online player.
Yeah.
With minimum investment.
With minimum investment. Yeah. And obviously, the only thing is because he's not tied to a big aggregator, if you will, is his geographical limitations are very real. Maybe
right.
A kilometer because he has a guy going on a bicycle and actually delivering it. So he can't really sort of have, or he has to tie up with a lot. But it's a mom and pop store, so people generally do not expect long range or long distance delivery.
Correct.
It's like really...
I mean, he's a localized guy. He already has the inventory. He has storage.
Yeah.
And he has a relationship with you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, perhaps he cannot scale way beyond whatever he's at the moment.
Yeah.
But he can compete.
Yeah.
You know, he can kind of make the pie smaller.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No,
unless the service from the online player is spectacularly better.
Yeah.
Correct. Which I don't think that differentiation exists anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And like just to give sort of a little bit of anecdotal tidbit on customer service, I remember ordering, getting some stuff for the home, and there was one product which the brand that I'd asked for, he didn't have. So when the runner came, he got three other brands of the same thing and said, like, you can take one of them. This is priced at this. If not, whatever, I'll take it back. So
right.
he was trying to make an effort, right? He was
right.
saying that, like, these are all homogeneous. So anyway, so yeah, I mean, onboarding offline stores, like getting O2O is sort of going to be the theme, next big theme, I guess, in the sort of local mom and pop area.
Yeah, so onboarding online to offline as well as, I think, wholesale.
Yeah, wholesale as well.
Wholesale platform is also something that they are, I think, looking at. So, yeah, it seems that they are kind of now being more focused and looking at, integrating their product with the rest of the group in terms of the proposition. So, but let's see. But, I mean, the interesting thing was that I think Alibaba would no longer give them the kind of slack they gave them earlier, right? I mean, I think they are going to be much more measured about...
Yeah, after they burned 200 million over the Diwali season,
yeah,
they'll be like, okay, you guys have to show some revenue growth or maybe some kind of growth number.
Yeah, revenue growth is not a problem, I guess.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
That's never been a problem. But I mean, it's a $650 million company now.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of valuation in 2 years. So, I mean, it makes me sometimes think, you know, if you look at, even Cred, we were talking about it last time. Cred became a $400 million company.
In like what, less than 2 years? Or 6 months, was it?
Yeah, 6 or 7 months. This is 600. So, I mean, yeah, valuations are kind of hitting the roof. No wonder. And, looking at high valuations, you track the markets. You see where Sensex and Nifty are hitting. Mm-hmm. I think Sensex
Lofty.
Is kind of like 39,000. And in terms of all-time high PEs, both of them, 30, 31 times earnings, Nifty 500.
Yeah.
So which is like a two-decade high.
Yeah.
And then when I saw that, on the side of it, I saw news which was talking about credit slowdown. I somehow was not able to,
dichotomy.
Yeah, connect both of them. Because, credit growth is pretty much a leading indicator, right?
Sure.
So
yeah,
what are the markets getting so bubbly about? So, what do you think?
Yeah, no, happening? I mean, that's obviously, this is, markets are such an interesting subject for not just you and me, but for general stock market or financial enthusiasts, because it can be argued either way. And there's always a counter argument to an argument, because that's how finance is. It's not, and there is no hence proved line, right?
Right.
So, I remember, I mean, before I sort of jump into what we're talking, but I remember in 2017 late, someone was telling me, like, forget technicals, forget fundamentals, forget everything. Just play elections and just knowing the sort of incumbent government it is and sort of that, let's call it capitalistic mindset or industry favoring policies they come, whatever it is, until election kicks off, just bet long on equity, right? Now, correlation equals causation, that's a big, let's not fall into that trap, but the call was right.
Right.
The markets have sort of held up. How much of it is elections, I don't know. But coming to your point, I know you track credit growth very closely and sort of look at it as a sort of, look for indicators on how it sort of, as precursor on how markets are reacting. For me, yes, they are overvalued. And I think credit growth, like you said, but their credit growth, again, there's a consumer side to it and there's an industrial side to it.
Correct.
Right? And I, for me, the big question mark on that is, there a time lag between sort of when the credit growth or when you actually see real capital being deployed by industries and when the economy sort of, the retail guys or the economy sort of catches up to that and starts reflecting in the growth numbers?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what it's like. It's if you look at like as a leading indicator, there are two sides of it, right? Yeah. Like obviously, like looking at the supply side is pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah.
But then that entire supply of credit has to be deployed, and then, you know, that deployment would have some sort of an ROI around it, which is going to, like, you know, churn more credit going forward.
Yeah.
So it's a cyclical thing. That's why, I mean, banks, their if you look at their earnings,
yeah,
it's a very cyclical business, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, what was interesting was that I saw two headlines side by side. One was markets at an all time high and credit growth at an all time low, and I was like, okay, like let's look at both of them in perspective. Then I just went into the I actually dug a bit of data, and you are absolutely right that, you know, the story that credit growth has slowed down, in my view, it's half the entire narrative here.
Yeah.
Because if you look at credit growth, it includes a lot of things.
Yeah.
It includes credit to manufacturing, it includes credit to services, it includes personal credit, consumer credit.
So right? Is there any trends you're seeing when you break that down into those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I think if you look at consumer credit side, you know, be it credit card loans, be it vehicle loans, be it mortgages, yeah, it has gone quite sluggish
okay.
at the moment. So I mean, if you look at last 1 year, I mean, on an year-on-year basis, from 20%, it has gone down to around 15-16%. And on an overall consumer credit basis, and if you look at these individual verticals separately within it, that's the reason why on the demand side of things, there's also a lot of data on how car productions have gone down, how car sales have gone down, how two-wheeler purchases have gone down, right? It's all pretty much linked to each other, right?
Yeah.
So that consumer credit side of thing slowing down, I agree with. But when you look at credit to industry and to services, things are not that bad, actually. I mean, if you look at industry itself, I mean, from almost 1% year-on-year growth in Feb 18, now that number has gone to 6%.
Okay, so that's sizable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, if you look at, like, last 10 years, maybe, I mean, it's not that significant. But at least in the last, you know, 12 to 24 months, industry credit has seen an uptick. Credit to services sector has seen an uptick. And I think what is happening is that the banking system overall, I think 24 months ago when the NPA crisis was at its peak, corporate credit was at an all-time low and consumer credit was beefed up.
Okay.
And now we are seeing a flip in that cycle.
Reversal, yeah.
Yeah. And now because most banks have provisioned sufficiently for, or at least that's kind of perceived as being sufficient for, you know, sufficient NPA provisions on their balance sheet. I think now they are again, they've deleveraged a fair bit, and now the product mix is again reversing, and you know, there's more credit towards the corporate side and consumer credit is now slowing down. So I think overall, if you look at it on a macro basis, consumption, sheer retail level consumption has definitely gone down.
Okay. And right? That's worrying a little bit.
That is definitely worrying. But if you look at investment in industry and in services, that looks pretty robust. How much of that investment is going to actually play out in the future? That's a question mark. But no wonder that's why markets are getting bubbly.
Yeah.
You know, because they are kind of betting on that, in addition to obviously election and all those other, you know, factors.
Yeah.
But in terms of fundamentals, I mean, I was earlier thinking that that entire, you know, Nifty 500 hitting a PE of 30, 31, all-time high. I earlier thought that that is completely unreasonable. That is completely pivoted to the election noise. But when I see the corporate credit data, I think there is a bit more than that to it.
Yeah. And I guess now what we are sort of seeing is there's a little bit of freshness in the sort of trends we are seeing, because those overhangs of demonetization and sort of GST can now be removed.
Absolutely.
Right? Because earlier it's much more difficult to feel like it's peeling the onion, right? You've got to filter out layers, and it's so difficult. We know that. In economics, it's just
don't worry. Crude oil prices are about to go up, are increasing. So I mean, I think that externality is kind of will get hedged out pretty soon.
Yeah, and then we'll get into the whole currency rate, FX rate discussion, and what it's doing. And
I mean, already we are seeing that. I think just because of elections, the news coverage is slightly lighter on that.
Yeah,
but I think ever since that US-Iran sanction waiver came in, I mean, India was, I think, hoping for another 6-month extension, but it hasn't gotten it.
Yeah.
So I think it's only about our time in the next month or two. You know, as temperatures soar to 40-45 degrees, prices of fuel are also going to go up. And yeah, then
unless we rapidly pivot to electric.
Yeah, unless we rapidly pivot to electric. Yeah, that's an excellent segue, Sharad, to our next...
Except that we're talking about just vehicles and we need oil for industries.
Yeah, that's correct. So you're talking about Tesla, right? Tesla's results came out this year and I think...
Quarterly
results, and I think you were a bit disappointed, were you?
I don't know if I was disappointed, but the numbers surely were.
Right.
Missed by a country mile, both on, let's call it revenue. They missed on revenue, they missed on earnings per share, and they burnt more cash than they were expected to. So obviously, you know, it was sort of disappointing in that sense.
Right.
But
I know you don't have, I don't think you hold Mr. Musk in a very high regard, do you? You have mixed views over him.
Who am I to sort of hold him in regard? But I'm skeptical of the company,
right,
in terms of, the like when you look at it from a
stock, I love the humility spin that you
but when you look at the company on a standalone basis, and let's just forget vision and let's just look at it from, if I were a shareholder, what is happening? And then I feel like there's just so much of noise around it, like from tweeting about going private to actually giving such bullish blue sky ideas. Like, shareholder communication has to be more crystallized, like it has to be more specific. It cannot just be a leap of faith. If that's the case, then sure, you know, then you just say, like, forget numbers, I'm going to be a private company, forget numbers, forget this. If you trust me on what I'm saying, then just, you know, give me some money and I'll help you become richer. Like, if that's what he says tomorrow, then I'll have a lot of respect. But if you start giving numbers, they've missed on the production numbers so many times, right? So there is his intellect and his ability as a engineer or as a operator or a vehicle, I'm fairly sure that it's excellent. But translating that into shareholder communication, I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you also looked at their, you were talking about their robotaxi venture, right?
I kind of saw it briefly because I saw that there were two headlines, I think, that the results are about to come out this week. And I think disappointment is in store. And on the side of it, Musk announces 1 million robot taxis, you know, come out on the road by next year or something.
Yeah, mid-2020, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I think when I asked you, you were saying that, you know, they did an analyst presentation like a day before the results, which is a bit unusual.
Yeah, a couple of days before, and right. I've seen this movie earlier, like people, it's frowned upon and probably not correct to say it, but there is a little bit of stock management that goes in these analyst days, like, I guess, like they want to sort of give out some good news ahead of some bad news incoming,
right,
so that you basically just play with, you know, the overall market narrative or try to plant thoughts. So obviously he's painted a very optimistic picture on Tesla and sort of saying that there'll be 1 million cars by mid-2020. How is that possible? I don't know. You need to do a more detailed dive, but the robot taxi narrative is pretty interesting, of having cars on the road with obviously driverless and all that. But one of the statements that he made is that a person who owns a Tesla can monetize that car by just putting it out there as a service, as a robot taxi, and can make about $30,000 a year. So that needs to be factored in your total cost of ownership, which makes it, quote unquote, insanely poor decision to financially insane decision to buy any other vehicle other than a Tesla. That's what he said.
Right.
Which, if true, yes, makes sense that if you can monetize a vehicle by $30,000 is a sizable number, right, per vehicle.
Let's break this down.
Yeah.
So basically, he's saying that in a year you'll have a fully automated or automized Tesla vehicle.
Not just that, there'll be 1 million of them flying.
Yeah,
there'll
be 1 million of them.
Yeah.
So they'll be driverless.
Yeah.
So the one idea is that Tesla is going to sell them to, I don't know, aggregators.
Correct.
Like Uber or Lyft.
Yeah.
Anyways, those guys are also working on their own automated driverless cars.
Yeah, and two biggest IPOs of this year, right?
Correct.
So, yeah.
So anyway, so platforms are going to buy them, right, and are going to deploy them on the road without drivers.
Sure.
The second is that he's saying that if you are a retail buyer of Tesla, you know, when you park your car and when you're at home or when you're at office, you can actually let it loose out there on the streets, meet other people.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And make money out of that. And make money. And right. Tesla will sort of, this is a gray area, that Tesla will themselves become an aggregator if they do that, because they will take 25 to 30% of the cut, they're saying. But yeah, after that deduction itself, they're saying a person can make about 30,000 bucks a year.
Okay.
So, yes, you're right. Like, so, so
I never knew that taxis had such killer margins.
I don't know.
You talk a lot to the Uber drivers whenever you guys get in a cab. They don't sound very happy, right? At least in India, they don't sound very happy.
In India, they definitely do not. I mean, they've seen the highs and lows. They used to be very happy when Uber first came in.
Right.
They were making good money. Like,
How much were they making?
There are people who were making close to 60,000-70,000 bucks a month.
Okay.
Rupees.
So now they're saying that that 60,000-70,000 will actually go in the pockets of the car owner directly?
After that cut, let's say, that will go directly into the, you know, and fuel costs are lower as well once it's electric.
I think the difference here is that the car owner doesn't have to be on the street. So that's just free money, right?
Yeah. And I mean, what it does to employment in, like, so India model is different, right? There, I mean, in North America, like, it's actually your car. You and I can sort of, you know, just sign up and drive if we're coming to work, pick up someone and make money. Here, you need a yellow commercial license number and things like that. The rules are very
different. But those rules are unavoidable even when Tesla comes up with anything.
It will.
The regulatory framework, driving ride hailing, it's only becoming more and more layered.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so, but I mean, I was wondering, you know, like, here's a legal question. You know, say I am a Tesla car owner and I like to make that $30,000 extra dollars per year, and I let my car loose and someone is picked up and he or she commits a crime in the car.
Who's liable?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
We should get a lawyer.
Where does it stand?
We should probably get a lawyer sometime on.
Can you sue an artificial intelligence system?
The owner of that, yeah, maybe. That's, again, when something so radical comes up, the entire ecosystem needs to be made, right?
Yeah.
Like, the same thing happened with drones. Like, no one knows how to regulate them.
Right.
So there are no laws. Like, people don't know. And it's the same thing with this. Like, I don't know how.
I think Musk realizes his the kind of soft power he is able to, you know, unleash. I mean, like, and he knows that, you know, if he, like, he says these outrageous things, right? I mean, he says things like, I mean, he's a visionary, obviously, no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But he says things like, yeah, we are going to colonize Mars, we are going to colonize the solar system, we are going to, you know, we are not going to travel in overhead trains, we are going to have tunnels all throughout the world. That's the fastest way to move. And now, you know, we are going to bring out Hyperloop. Now he's saying that, you know, we'll have robotaxi. Everybody starts wondering, oh, okay, can this be done?
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's just a lot of blue sky thinking, and good, some bad, but it's interesting. He's also, the technology that he wants to get, like, the other sort of people who are working on this autonomous driving, they use something called LiDAR, I think. Light detection and range system, which is used for autonomous driving. I think he's sort of saying that technology is worthless and we're not going to use it. So basically, Google is using that.
Okay.
And they're bullish on that. So this guy's taking, like, that's useless and he's just shutting it aside.
Okay.
So let's see. I mean, it's how that plays out is going to be an interesting story. Like, it seems like out of the movies, science fiction movies, to actually go in a car where there's no one sitting. When that happens.
No, I mean, I think in terms of, I think driverless cars are something which all ride hailing platforms are seeking for. Right?
Yeah, it's such a big cost saver.
Yeah, exactly. And when it's funny, they refer to the drivers as partners, but you know, once they can kind of ease them out, that's not an issue at all. But I mean, that's something definitely that's going to, I mean, I think technologically that's something which is going to be doable in the next few years.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe in small pockets of the world. I mean, like, for instance, I think Lyft, their pilot of the driverless car, I don't know whether it was Lyft or some other company, I forgot the name. I mean, I might be wrong there, but there's an aggregator in the US who brought driverless cars. And they tested it only in, you know, those retirement home communities.
Okay.
Because their idea was that, you know, there is those are big pieces of land, right? But those roads are all internal roads.
Okay.
So they don't come under the rules of mainstream authorities.
Okay.
It's like, you know, it's a gated community having a golf cart, right? So nobody's going to...
Ring-fenced,
It's ring-fenced, right?
Yeah.
And, but still, you have a fair bit of acreage in terms of, in terms of covering the area. Secondly, retired people, they are generally a bit apprehensive of driving.
Yeah.
So, they are open to the idea of, someone driving them around. And they usually have a very... set schedule of daily activities, right? Like, in the morning they might go for a swim, then in the evening they might go for a round of bridge, they go to the clubhouse on a daily basis. So a roster can be, fairly conveniently organized.
Yeah.
electronically. And so that's the, I mean, so it's already happening, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't see it a big flight of imagination. But, you know, that being said, I think there is so much regulatory catch-up which needs to happen on the side.
Yeah.
That is firstly. And secondly, I mean, there is a bit of BS in this as well. I mean, for instance, like in solar, I mean, for years altogether, the argument in solar used to be that, you know, okay, if you're producing extra energy, you can feed it back into the grid and you can make some money out of it.
Yeah.
Right? This is pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
But till the regulatory regime is, you know, fully stabilized around that idea.
Well, reselling rules, right?
Yeah, yeah. It will be years before which I'd actually come. So I'm pretty sure like all visionaries, you have to be excessively bullish about it on day one, right? But I mean, it might take like a decade or two before it kind of really gets commercialized properly on ground.
Yeah.
Because for instance, like in India, like when the entire electricity reselling thing came, I mean, rules had to be changed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that, okay, as an individual, am I allowed to resell electricity? Am I not? If I don't have, like for instance, I mean, for solar, maybe that's not a big problem now, but like for an electric vehicle, am I allowed to set up a charging station?
Yeah.
You know, if I'm an individual, for a long period of time, I wasn't, right? Now, the rules are somewhat
changed,
falling in that ballpark.
Yeah.
Still not precise enough, but yeah, it takes that time. So that, I think that regulatory delay always has a big role to play, right?
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, I was reading this report and from some German study, which is saying that electric vehicles will actually not help reduce CO2 emissions. They will in fact increase it.
Nice.
Because the logic is that mining of lithium, cobalt and manganese, the amount of CO2 emitted mining of those metals way offsets the emissions caused by diesel. So they're sort of thing, you can't call them zero emission vehicles just because they're emitting zero emission while on the road. But battery pack that uses these metals, the mining of those emits so much of CO2 that it entirely offsets it. In fact, they gave some numbers that there are 11 to 15 tons of CO2 emitted per battery pack of Tesla.
Okay.
So that they're saying that sort of already. That's interesting. So we can.
That is interesting, and I think along with that, obviously the power capacity also has to be expanded, right?
Yeah.
When you're going electric, so you should kind of tag Mr. Musk on Twitter
and ask
point him towards this report. I don't know what can say. He might react. I mean, we'll post the link to the report in the description.
Sure, let's do that.
And well, you know, like in terms of regulations, I think what is there's one thing that, you know, when we're talking about regulator trying to catch up, in one area the Indian regulator I think is catching up, you know, when it comes to fintech, the regulatory sandbox. I mean, something that I feel very emotional about. I think they introduced a draft sometime last week, which, you know, kind of quote unquote puts an enabling framework for setting up a regulatory sandbox. So, you know, like regulatory sandbox being a kind of testing mechanism.
Yeah, more innovation now. That's
more innovation now. So the regulator won't touch you during the testing phase.
Yeah.
So the document is very interesting because they excluded Bitcoins, cryptocurrencies out of it.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. So that's how. So, I mean, no sandbox protection for it today or for the future. So, yeah, I mean, they are kind of catching up, but not as much.
Yeah, that's actually a little surprising, but sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think with that, we can close today's season finale.
Yeah, and, episode and the season.
Episode 32. And yeah, we'll hopefully see everyone back in mid-May on schedule with something new and something more exciting. And goes without saying, all listeners, please do feel free to chip in with your comments and your feedback. So that, you know, we can make this a better podcast for you. And this is a golden time because season 3 is about to come. So there is some transition period in which we can, you know, improve things or change things, because we like to follow what I like to say, a structured approach.
Go back to the chalkboard, as you say.
Yeah, whiteboard, sir.
Whiteboard, yeah.
Whiteboard. And yeah, thank you so much, and have a nice weekend. This is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.